Welcome to We Empower, the radio show that inspires you to embrace your potential, resilience, and strength. In these challenging times, we're here to help you unlock your power to overcome obstacles, pursue your dreams, and shape a brighter future. I'm Anna Bertanes, your host for this empowering hour. Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of We Empower. I'm thrilled to have you all with us today. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired. Let's make today count. In today's episode, we were waiting to have a great guest here to introduce. It is Raoul Krauthausen, and he's very well known as he's a wheelchair activist, inclusion pioneer, and founder of Sozialhelden. From brittle bones to breaking barriers, his fight for accessibility inspires millions. And I'm very sorry that we don't have him here, but I'm very happy that we have an interview here with him, and I will tell you something around. And we will start then now with a song selected by Raoul Krauthausen.
An allem sind die Männer schuld, Machos meistens weiße. Sie sind voll verantwortlich für die ganze Scheiße. Sie regieren diese Welt, sie haben zu viel Macht. Sie haben unseren Planeten auf den Hund gebracht. Gibt es größere Schurken? Die Antwort lautet nein. Doch auch lesbische, schwarze, Behinderte können ätzend sein. Ich traf eine bei Obi, sie fuhr in ihrem Rollstuhl, drängelt sich an der Kasse vor und zahlt dann auch noch voll cool. Mit einem 1000-Markschein, sie hatte nur 10 Schrauben. Das würde sich doch ein normaler Deutscher nicht erlauben. Da schimpfte die Kassiererin und alle stimmten ein. Auch lesbische, schwarze Behinderte können ätzend sein. Draußen auf dem Parkplatz, da fuhr sie mich fast um. Sie sagte nicht Entschuldigung, sie brüllte, bist du dumm. Ich bremse auch für Männer, stand groß auf ihrer Brust. Da hab ich so spontan kein gutes Wort gewusst. Ich hätte fick dich rufen sollen, das fiel mir zu spät ein. Auch lesbische, schwarze Behinderte können ätzend sein. Natürlich bin ich kein Rassist, ich hab vorm Kopf kein Brett. Die meisten lesbischen, schwarzen Behinderten sind alle furchtbar nett. Man sieht sie viel zu selten in keiner Fernsehshow. Nicht mal in der Lindenstraße, ich weiß nicht wieso. Geht dieses Lied noch weiter? Die Antwort lautet nein, doch auch lesbische, schwarze Behinderte können ätzend sein.
Dankeschön.
So welcome to this show, and normally we wanted to welcome here Raoul Krauthausen, who is a very well-known activist, wheelchair activist, and we started with a song selected by him, which has the title Lesbian Black Skinned Handicapped from Fanny van Danen. And it is interesting because this song is really special, not only because it's in German, but the most important line of this song is, what kind of world is this where one cannot simply love? Nine captures the essence of the song's critic, the social barriers and prejudices that complicate or hinder love, acceptance, and coexistence. It challenges listeners to reflect on the absurdity of a world where something as fundamental as love is obstruced by labels, biases, or systemic discrimination. The universal simplicity of the question makes it poignant, leaving a lasting emotional and moral impact. Rob Kohlhausen, he's not here today, but he left me an interview, which I'm happy to talk about first and continue then with a book selected for you. This talk show, two books selected for you, which are both very interesting because it could be life changer for you. So starting with Roald Krauthausen, he is definitely somebody who is, amongst other visible, he's a trailblazing activist, author, and speaker known for his relentless advocacy for inclusion and accessibility. As a wheelchair user himself, he has reshaped conversations about disability rights, challenging stereotypes, and fighting for a barrier-free world. Whether through his social media presence, his thought-provoking books, or his inspiring talks, Krauthausen empowers others to see diversity as strength and inclusion as a necessity. As inclusion activist and founder of Sozialhelden, in English, Social Heroes, Roald Krauthausen has spent over 15 years working in the internet and media world, leveraging this expertise as a communication specialist and design thinker. The internet is a second home, where he tweets, blogs, and posts about the issues that move him, sometimes humorous, sometimes serious, and often with a sharp tongue. Krauthausen is best known for inventing WheelMap, a global digital map of wheelchair-accessible places created by users, as well as for his undercover care home experiment and his protest against Germany's Federal Participation Act. A wheelchair user himself, Raul was born in Peru, attended school in Germany, and graduated high school in 2001. He began his career as an online concept developer at several companies, including Apparat Multimedia and Neue Digitale. In 2002, he started studying social and business communication at the University of the Arts. 2 years later, he co-founded the activist network Social Helden with his cousin Jan Mersch to raise awareness and social issues and inspire change. Their efforts have earned numerous awards, including the Neon Smart Idea Competition, German Engagement Award, German Citizen Award. Roll has a talent for initiating practical social projects and securing funding and sponsorships. In 2007, he launched the Fantastisch Helfen project, which won the Start Social Award. He also created the website Late Median, an online guide to language and disability, which was nominated for a Grimme Online Award. The German business magazine Wirtschaftswoche ranked him on the list of the most important figures in Germany's internet economy. Krauthausen joined forces with other disability rights activists to launch a Nicht mein Gesetz campaign, advocating for better participation laws. Since 2011, he has been an Ashoka Fellow, dedicating himself fully to Sozialhelden Ability Watch. He oversees project management and strategy, representing 15 ongoing Sozialhelden projects while advocating for their vision. Raul is also a sought-after speaker, addressing topics such as inclusion, accessibility, and innovation at various events. Since 2015, he has hosted his own talk show, Face to Face, focusing on culture and inclusion. He has developed web video productions for platforms like Zed, CDF, and other TV shows and TV channels. Additionally, he publishes a weekly newsletter. Raul's achievements include receiving the Federal Cross of Merit in 2013 for his social engagement and the Grimme Online Award. Different other awards are along his way, and he is Germany's most prominent voice for inclusion. So I would like to share with you an interview. When did you first realize you were disabled or different? I probably first fully realized it during my school years, when sports stopped being just about fun and started revolving around competition. I couldn't keep up in these contests and noticed that I was different from others. Of course, I was already aware that I needed a wheelchair, but others didn't, and that I was more prone to breaking bones. But I didn't see myself as disabled because I didn't feel like a limitation. My parents and friends always made me feel included, so I rarely faced barriers. How did your parents cope with having a disabled child? My parents were pragmatic from the very beginning. I was born in Peru, but they moved to Germany because the basic conditions for disabled people were better here. I imagine my parents spent far time in doctors' offices and administrative agencies than other families, and that I required more care. However, they knew from the start that they couldn't always be there for me. I wanted me to build an independent life. My upbringing was focused heavily on fostering independence. They insisted I attend an inclusive school and graduate. When I once mentioned wanting to quit school instead of finishing my A-levels, they dreadfully responded, "But you can't become a roofer either." Looking back, their pragmatism helped me far more than overprotectiveness would have. What was your childhood like with a disability? My childhood wasn't much different from that of other kids. Because of my brittle bones, I broke a lot of them while playing, but my mother, being a doctor, saved us countless trips to the hospital. I did have to spend extended periods in hospital for major surgeries, which was, of course, annoying, just like it would be for any child. But aside from that, I had a very happy childhood, full of friends and fun. What does it mean to live with brittle bone and disease? That's a tough question because I don't have a comparison to love without it. I have to be more careful in some situations. For instance, not bumping into a lamp post while playing with my phone in my wheelchair. But that could probably happen to me even without brittle bones. I do need to plan my everyday life more thoroughly than people without disabilities every day. In the mornings and evenings, I rely on assistants to help me with various tasks. However, for the issues I care about and advocate for, my personal disability is irrelevant. Whether I have brittle bones, muscular atrophy, or a spinal cord injury, we all face similar environmental barriers, stairs, steps, and lack of inclusion. My disability is a private matter. It shouldn't serve to satisfy the voyeuristic curiosity of readers or journalists. How often have you broken your bones? I've stopped counting. It's probably more than 100 times. How tall are you? Around 1 meter. When did you stop growing? When I started playing my tin drum. Who helps you in everyday life? I have assistants who help me in the morning and evenings and take care of household tasks. They are like my extended arms. At work, my colleagues help me, for instance, with doors or fetching my laptop. In what situations do you feel disabled? I like to look at the word disabled from another perspective. Often we see people in wheelchairs or with visual impairments and immediately think, that person is disabled. But in those moments, the person may not feel disabled at all. They might see the wheelchair as a tool of freedom, not limitation. However, when you face a high step, a staircase, or a broken elevator, that's when you're disabled. Or more precisely, when you are being disabled. These barriers can be architectural, but they often appear in bureaucracy too. For instance, I have to disclose all my data to the tax office and let them scrutinize me entirely. That's why I advocate for better participation laws for disabled people, so financial circumstances are considered independently of disability. No one chooses to be disabled, but society can choose whether to disable someone or not. Do you get used to drawing attention from others? I don't think I will ever be completely at ease with it because I enjoy observing people, but it's hard to do when everyone's already looking at me. They've said, I've learned to handle it more calmly over time by trying to understand why it happens. However, when someone stares persistently or speaks to me in a strange way, reducing me to my disability, it still bothers me. How do people react to you? Do others pity you? I'm rarely pitied to my face. It's more behind my back, when people assume they know how hard my life must be because they've done some volunteer work or civil service before. I find that uncomfortable because no one should presume to understand how someone else feels. Do people make fun of you? Rarely. It happens more anonymously online, in comments or emails like, what kind of weird dwarf are you? But that doesn't get to me. There are odd people everywhere. Can you laugh at disability jokes? Yes, I can, but I don't like talent disability jokes myself because it's one of the first things journalists or media people often ask about. Humor is great, but it shouldn't be a token gesture like, okay, we've talked about inclusion for 5 minutes. Now let's tell some jokes. That's too superficial for me. Let's make progress on inclusion first, and then we can laugh about jokes together. What terms do you prefer when being addressed? I like the term person with a disability because it puts the person first, but I prefer terms that don't focus on my disability at all. Once I was referred to as the man with the hat, and I thought that was fantastic. So, thank you very much, Raul, that you shared this with us, as even you couldn't take part here. And of course, Raul is a very special person. If you imagine a world where every step is a barrier, where society limits instead of potential, Raul Krauthaus knows this word, but he refuses to accept it. Born with brittle bony disease, he shattered stereotypes instead of bones, transforming his wheelchair into a vehicle for change. From creating Wheelmap, a global tool for accessibility, to leading protests against discriminatory laws, Raul's voice echoes far and beyond, far beyond Germany. His secret? Turning frustration into action and isolation into solidarity. Today, he's not just living with disability, he's redefining what's possible. This is a story with or without him. We thank Raul for being here on Earth, even if he can't make it to be here today. So, the next part after the small break will be connecting the dots. And this was today's morning, also very important because knowing really at 9 about Raul not being able to attend here, this is exactly what you need to do, connecting the dots. Staying calm, knowing that everything has a meaning and that we can do better in every situation, just if we make a break, step in a wider perspective, look from a wider angle, and then decide. So I brought to you on this very great big love because it's also part of my world. It's part of my life and it's guiding me through every day. And I will share a bit later after the break of the 2 minutes more with you. So first of all, we will get into the small commercial break and continue afterwards my conversation with you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
So now let's move on to the introduction of an inspiring book, which could be a life changer. For me, today, it was it. Because how do you get up in the morning? Do you get up in the morning with a feeling of uncertainty? Or do you know exactly what you want to do? Maybe you have your cup of coffee in the morning, always the same cup of coffee. And maybe you eat your muesli afterwards. Always the same kind of muesli. And maybe then you take your bus, always at the same time to your job. Or maybe you drive the car, always the same direction. And this is your certainty of the day, because our world is so full of uncertainties that cultivating some rituals may be the thing for you, which gives you some certainty. But cultivating serendipity may be the most future-proof skill you have. So in the morning, when I heard that Ralph Krauthausen is ill and he can't make it to be here, I thought, what would be my listeners, what would my listeners to be happy to listen to? So connect the dots on the art and science of creating good luck. I think this is a book you've earned by Dr. Christian Busch. There are books that inform, and then there are books that transform. When I first opened Connect the Dots, I wasn't looking for luck. I was searching for meaning and unpredictability of life. Maybe today it could have been too. What I found was much more a perspective shift, a hopeful lens on uncertainty, and a toolkit for creating serendipity, not just waiting for it. I was asked a few days ago from a journalist what I think, what is the most important, IQ or EQ? So the intelligence quotient or the emotional quotient? I said, none of this. It is the AQ, the adaptability quotient. Because if we can't work, if we can't run, if we can't move with the speed of life, with the uncertainty of life, with the changes of life, then we will lose us and the people around us. So, connecting the dots, Dr. Christian Busch doesn't just write. He speaks to a deep human yearning to make sense of chaos and find purpose in the unexpected. His stories move, his science convinces, and his message uplifts. Luck isn't just stumbled upon. It can be learned, nurtured, even designed. What makes this book so powerful is that it doesn't shy away from the messiness of life. Instead, it teaches us to dance with it. From business leaders to frontline workers, from unexpected conversations to chance encounters, Bush shows how serendipity can change everything when we are open, curious, and courageous. By the time I turned the last page, I didn't just understand luck differently. I trusted life a little more. Connect the dots is not just a book. It's an invitation to live more attentively, generously, and boldly, and optimistic. Dr. Christian Busch is not your typical business thinker. Born in Germany, raised between cultures, and educated at the London School of Economics, his perspective is refreshingly global and deeply human. He co-founded Leaders on Purpose and Sandbox Network, two platforms focused on unlocking human potential through impact-driven leadership and innovation. Currently a professor at New York University and formerly at the London School of Economics, his teaching is rooted in purpose, serendipity, and inclusive growth. What sets Busch apart is his obsession with what many dismiss, happy accidents. But he doesn't just believe in luck, he studies it. Through years of research across cultures, companies, and crises, he has developed a new understanding of how serendipity works and how we can cultivate it. His own life, marked by unexpected turns and multicultural experiences, shaped his fascination with uncertainty. He's driven by a desire to democratize the opportunity to teach individuals how to find meaning where others see randomness. Busch's work is deeply interdisciplinary, blending psychology, economics, sociology, and storytelling. His motivation? To help people not just survive the unknown, but thrive in it. Connect the Dots was born out of a single burning question. Why do some people consistently turn the unexpected into opportunity, while others don't? Dr. Busch has observed this pattern across diverse industry and communities. Whether in Silicon Valley startup social enterprises in Kenya or corporations in Europe, the most successful people weren't always the most prepared, but they were the most perceptive. He realized that many people misunderstand luck as a pure chance. What if, he thought, luck could be a skill? What if people could be trained to notice and act on the unexpected? The book is his response to his insight. Part research, part life philosophy, part practical guide. It synthesizes our decade of fieldwork, academic research, and personal stories. Bush wanted to write something that could help people find direction in chaos, especially in a world where change is the only constant. At its core, Connect the Dot. Connect the Dots is about reclaiming agency in an unpredictable world. Serendipity isn't luck by accident, it's luck by design. So I would like to close this review with 7 practical tips from the book I put together. First, cultivate a serendipity mindset. Be open, curious, and prepared to reframe the unexpected. Second, ask what if questions. Curiosity opens doors to hidden possibilities. 3. Create hooks in conversations. Leave rooms for others to make unexpected connections. 4. Learn to see bridges, not just gaps. Use uncertainty as a link, not a block. 5. Practice a serendipity spotting habit. Reflect regularly on how chance played a role in your day. 6. Turn mistakes into stepping stones. Often failure is a disguised form of luck. 7. Be generous with your network. Sharing opportunities makes serendipity contagious. So I would like to summarize this with 5 powerful quotes from the book. Serendipity is smart luck. It's about seeing what others miss and acting on it. The unexpected is not the enemy. It's a raw material of innovation. We don't find meaning by avoiding chaos, but by dancing with it. Those who connect the dots don't have better dots. They just see patterns others overlook. And in a world of uncertainty, cultivating serendipity may be the most future-proof skill we have. What if you turn it on the mirror to watch what Krauthausen does? Well, we are, mostly of us listening here, maybe without a wheelchair, maybe without breaking bones all the time, where the unexpected, the uncertainty, as somebody who's always with us. What if we turn this into a strength and see how important it is to work with it and see how this can give us another strength, because life is changing more than ever because of us, but also because of others. And I will read a bit from this book. The stimulated mind acting on it. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up people to collect wood and don't assign them tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea. Attributed to Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. Imagine a jigsaw puzzle with some missing pieces. Initially, you might not have a clear idea of a final picture, so you don't know what the missing pieces look like. A bit of someone's face, a patch of cloud, the corner of a house. But as you assemble the puzzle piece by piece, you get a sense of the complete picture and a better idea of what's missing. You start to see how the missing pieces fit into the overall image. Similarly, in your personal life or career, the different pieces you have assembled, your skills, knowledge, and experience, might not fit together intuitively at first. But over time, they start to form a bigger picture. Once you have that, you can search for the missing elements. Perhaps you realize that you are missing a skill that could transform your life. Even if you cannot be specific, you may have a broad sense of what is lacking. I have too little technical experience, or I need to be a better communicator. Then you can search for the missing pieces with a clearer focus. In these situations, it is good that hindsight and foresight complement each other. We often can make sense of things only in hindsight, but our foresight allows us to complete the puzzle. Everyone has their own particular approach, perspective, and aspirations that lead them to spot unexpected opportunities. In fact, research suggests that having a certain broader motivation or a sense of direction can help us to experience serendipity more often and with better outcomes. Motivation of some kind is essential. We have to want to see the trigger. We have to want to connect the dots. Naturally, everyone is motivated differently. For some, a search for meaning is paramount. For others, principles rule. For still others, caring is key. And it would be foolish to rule out other motivations such as abstract curiosity, a need to belong, a strong sex drive, envy, or greed. As we've seen, serendipity is an active pursuit. An open mind is nothing without the emotional and inspirational setup, the willingness and motivation to steer ourselves in a desirable direction, even if the exact destination is unknown. As we recognized in the previous chapter, we must actively want serendipity to happen to us, rather than just thinking illy that one day it might. But how can we develop an outlook that helps us to truly experience serendipity and become the person we are capable of becoming? When Evelina Gismanafichi-Tüte arrived in London in the summer of 2004 for an extended holiday, little did she imagine that her ward would end up staying in the United Kingdom for good. Born in a small village in Lithuania, she was looking forward to exploring London with her then boyfriend. They had been invited to stay with a friend and had planned to return at the end of the holiday, exactly, of course, to Vilnius, where Evelina had already secured a fully funded place in the city's university. In a stroke of bad luck, by the time Evelina arrived in the UK, her friend had lost her job and needed to charge rent, turning Evelina's dream of exploring the country unexpectedly into a desperate hunt for a job that would enable her to fund her stay. Evelina eventually found unemployment as a cleaner in a small hotel. She worked long hours, often humiliated by the other staff for being a foreigner who didn't speak English. Then the unimaginable happened. I was cleaning the room when I suddenly heard the opening of the door behind me. There was this guy I worked with, a sleazy, overweight man with greasy hair, rotten teeth, and a permanent smell of whiskey and tobacco. He placed a Do Not Disturb sign on the door, locked it, and walked towards me with a wide grin on his face, undoing his belt. I was shocked and frightened and backed off as he tried to force himself on me. Fortunately, there was an unlocked door to an adjacent room, and I was lucky to make a narrow escape. Evelina ran out into London's busy Oxford Street with her cleaning gloves on, still wearing her blue maid's dress and white apron. She ran mindlessly to nowhere among crowds of people, all dressed and suited, purposefully making their way to wherever they were heading. Suddenly, a voice began to play in her head like a scratched record. I'm better than this. I'm better than this. I'm better than this. She decided there must be more to life. With purposeful optimism and drive, she wandered the streets of London the next day looking for a new job, and she was delighted to see the French sign of a Pret a Manger sandwich shop. Convinced that the fluent French she learned at school would be helpful, she found the manager and started speaking to him confidently in that language. The tall Italian looked down at her with a smile and curiosity in his face, and after listening to her for a while, muttered that she did not speak French, that Pret was not a French company, and that they did not need any new employees. He nevertheless found a job for her, although Evelina still can't understand why. After helping her to open a bank account and acquire the necessary work permit, he sent her to another Pret shop and he knew was hiring. There, Evelina quickly climbed the career ladder, her hard work and positive attitude making up her for language deficit. Most of the staff spoke Polish, which she had learned as a child watching television and used for fun to entertain Polish visitors to the famous churches of her hometown. Her holiday forgotten, Evelina remained at Pret and within a few years progressed to senior management roles, ultimately leading business development projects to expand Pret's operations to new locations, opening new stores, training new managers and leaders. More than a decade has passed since then. Evelina lives with her daughter outside London and has her own consulting, training and coaching business, Elite Mind Limited. She feels that she is living a happy and fulfilled life. Today, she uses her confidence and her energy to inspire others and to help remove limiting beliefs that might keep people stuck in ruts. Evelina's experience in the hotel is truly terrible, so it's inspiring that, like many of the people I interviewed for this book, she used this traumatic event as a starting point to reorient her life, really finding her direction on her own terms rather than letting herself be defined and crushed by a negative event. People like Evelina derive a strong sense of direction, drive, and meaning out of crises. Others have an intuitive sense of where they are going or strive towards a higher purpose. Those who practice a religion might seek such orientation in scripture. Others might rely on philosophy or other guiding principles. A company's executives might articulate a vision that describes why they do what they do. In more ways than one, I have been able to observe at first hand the fact that often we don't know where exactly we want to go. What I have observed in both myself and many other people is that we think less about a particular goal or venture and more about an opportunity space that allows us to explore what excites us. And then usually we stumble over opportunities that feel right. Once we think about companies, communities, and universities are platforms that can help us determine and enable our own journey of experimentation, we can develop skill set while at the same time exploring which setting is most meaningful to us. It allows us to place bets. When I started my PhD, the deal I made with my then supervisor was simple. I would focus on my research and he would let me help to develop an innovation center. That way, I had the opportunity to research, but at the same time was able to take on a role as inaugural deputy director that was relevant to the outside world and helped me find the area in which I felt most at home. The LSE, in particular the Innovation and Co-Creation Lab I helped to develop, turned out to be a wonderful opportunity platform and experimentation space for me. It helped me facilitate projects such as CSR, Society, the Sandbox Networks, and Leaders and Purpose, based on the people I met and the opportunities that emerged serendipitously from these encounters. They naturally happened over the years, and I somehow felt certain that something positive would happen, even though I did not know what exactly it would be. How could I be so sure? Insights from the natural sciences can help us answer the questions, particularly the famous theory in biology of adjacent possibilities refers to the idea that every interaction in an ecosystem increases the potentiality of what can happen next. Jonathan Carlin, co-founder of Unsettled, a platform that gives people the opportunity to spend time with others in different locations around the world, loves life according to this notion. It helps him understand that even if something is not possible at this point, it will be as soon as some other immediate possibilities happen. Like Herm was able to make a diamond over time, with every interaction a new infinite universe of possibilities open up, ready to be discovered. And we can choose to be open to those new opportunities, turning the fear of the unknown into the joy of seeing what's possible and upcoming. This can make us feel vulnerable and depends on how much uncertainty we are comfortable with, but it makes clear that it is impossible to map out everything in advance. So if you run into the Dalai Lama tomorrow and he asks you to become a senior advisor, that might not have been on your radar, but it would open up a wealth of new possibilities. Every new interaction with a person or an idea broadens our opportunity space into areas we might not have been able to imagine. And with this, unfortunately, I have to stop reading this book. And maybe you like it and you can read it later. Or maybe you want to take some further pieces out of it. Or you've learned already something you can use. So we have now another commercial break. And after a couple of minutes, we will see each other here for another inspiration for you. And I'm sure you will like it. So please stay tuned and be with us after the commercial break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle Magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Now I have another inspiration for you for today. It's about revenge of the tipping point, over stories, super spreaders, and the rise of social engineering from Malcolm Gladwell. That's a moment of Malcolm Gladwell's revenge of the tipping point where you realize everything you thought you knew about how ideas spread is wrong. It's unsettling, accelerating, like discovering gravity works sideways. Gladwell doesn't just explain social epidemics. He makes you feel them, the way a match feels the moment before it ignites. With a signature blend of storytelling and science, he forces us to confront an uncomfortable truth. Change doesn't happen gradually. It explodes. And the people who control those explosions, whether for good or ill, hold terrifying power. This book is a wake-up call, a manifesto, and a warning. It reads like a thriller where the villain is complacency and the hero is anyone brave enough to ask, what if we've been playing the wrong game all along? By the end, he will see the world differently, the way a chess master sees the board or a virus sees the crowded rooms. And once you see it, you can't unsee it ever, ever again. Malcolm Gladwell, the man who connects the dots. Malcolm Gladwell wasn't just born to write. He was born to rearrange how we think. The son of a Jamaican mathematician and British psychotherapist, he grew up in a rural Canada, where his outsider perspective became a superpower. Before the tipping point made him a household name, he was a Washington Post reporter, obsessively digging into the hidden patterns behind success, failure, and human behavior. Gladwell's genius lies in his ability to turn academic research into gripping narratives. He is a detective of ideas, uncovering the why behind everything, from why some songs go viral to why some revolutions fail. His curiosity is insatiable. Whether he's dissecting hockey players both months or the psychology of snap judgments, but Revenge of the Tipping Point is different. It's his most urgent work yet, written not just to inform, but to arm us. Gladwell didn't just revisit the tipping point for nostalgia. He wrote this book because his stages have never been higher. An era of misinformation, algorithmic manipulation, and ideological warfare, understanding how ideas spread isn't just academic, it's survival. He watched as the social media turned into a battleground where bad actors weaponized the very principle he once described. This book is his counterattack. It's about reclaiming agency in a world where viral lies spread faster than truth, where a single tweet can topple governments, and where the rules of influence have been hacked. Gladwell isn't just updating his theory, he's sounding the alarm. The tipping point isn't just a theory, it's a weapon. And whoever controls it controls the future. So my 7 key lessons from the book I would like to share with you. First, super spreaders rule the world. A handful of people or algorithms dictate what goes viral. Second, stickiness is engineered. Memorable ideas aren't accidents, they're designed. Third, context is everything. The same idea fails or flourishes based on when and where it lands. Fourth, the law of the few. Connectors, mavens, and salesmen still drive epidemics, but now they are bots. Fifth, social proof is exploitable. We follow crowds, even off cliffs. Sixth, the threshold of change. Small shifts can trigger avalanches if you know where to push. And seventh, the dark side of virality. What spreads fastest is not always what's true or good. Glenward's revenge of the tipping point is a masterclass in how ideas conquer the world and how we can fight back. It's both a mirror and a map, showing us how we are being manipulated and how we can reclaim control. And I would like to end this review with 5 quotes. Epidemics don't rise gradually, they strike like lightning. The future belongs to those who understand the roots of contagion and break them. A lie wrapped in emotions travels faster than the truth carrying data. The most dangerous people aren't the loudest, they're the ones who make silence spread. To change the world, you don't need anyone, you don't need everyone, you just need the right few. This isn't just a book, it's a survival guide for the information age. So read it more, someone else use it against you. And with this, I would like to step into the book and read a bit from it. Revenge of the Tipping Point. The Bomber Math here, talking to strangers, David and Goliard, what the dog saw, outliers, Link, the tipping point. Our stories, super spreaders, and the rise of social engineering. 25 years ago, I published my first book. It was entitled The Tipping Point, How Little Things Make a Big Difference. Back then, I had a little apartment in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan, and I would sit at my desk with a glimpse of the Hudson River off in its distance and write in the mornings before I headed to work. Because I'd never written a book, I had no clear idea about how to do it. I wrote with this mix of self-doubt and euphoria common to every first-time author. The Tipping Point is a biography of an idea. I began, and the idea is very simple. It is hard the best way to understand the emergence of fashion trends, the ebb and flow of crime waves, or for that matter, the transformation of unknown books into bestsellers, or the rise of teenage smoking, or the phenomena of word of mouth, or a number of the other mysterious changes that mark everyday life, is to think of them as epidemics. Ideas and products and messages and behaviors spread just like viruses too. The book was published in the spring of 2000, and the first stop on my book tour was a reading at a small independent bookstore in Los Angeles. 2 people came, a stranger and the mother of a friend of mine, but not my friend. I have forgiven her. I said to myself, well, I guess that's it. But it wasn't. The tipping point grew like the epidemics it described. At first gradually, then all in a rush. By the time the paper came out, it enters the zeitgeist. The book spent several years on the New York Times bestseller list. Bill Clinton referred to it as the book everyone has been talking about. The phrase tipping point became part of the vernacular. I used to joke that those words would be written on my tombstone. Do I know whether tipping point touched us a chord? Not really. But I had to guess, I would say that it was because it was a hopeful book that matched the mood of a hopeful time. The new millennium had arrived. Crime and social problems were in a free fall. The Cold War was over. I offered in my book a recipe for how to promote positive change. As a subtitle, we suggested to find a way for title Little Things to Make a Big Difference. 25 years is a long time. Think about how different you are today than you were a quarter century ago. Our opinions change. Our tastes change. We care more about some things and less about others. Over the year, I would sometimes look back on what I had written in The Tipping Point, and I wonder how I ever came to write the things I did. An entire chapter on the children's television shows Sesame Street and Blue's Clues. Where did they come from? I didn't even have children back then. I moved on to write Blink, Outliers, David and Goliard, Talking to Strangers, and The Bomber Mafia. I started the podcast Revisionist History. I settled down with a woman I love. I had 2 children and buried my father. I took up running again and cut my hair. I sold the Chelsea apartment. I moved out of the city. A friend and I started an audio company called Pushkin Industries. I got a cat and named him Biggie Smalls. You know the feeling of looking at a picture of yourself from long ago? When I do that, I have difficulty recognizing the person in the photograph. And so I thought it might be interesting to revisit the tipping point on the occasion of a 25th birthday to re-examine what I wrote so long time ago through a very different set of eyes. In the tipping point 2022, a writer would return to the scene of his first youth success. But then, as I immersed myself once again in the world of social epidemics, I realized that I didn't want to return to the same ground I had covered in the tipping point. The world seems too different to my eyes. In the tipping point, I introduced a series of principles to help us make sense of the key and kinds of sudden shifts in behavior and beliefs that make up our world. I still consider those ideas useful, but now I have different questions, and I find that I still do not understand many things about social epidemics. When I reread The Tipping Point in preparation for this project, I found myself stopping every few pages to ask, what about this? How could I have left out that? In some far corner of my mind, I discovered I'd never stopped arguing with myself about how best to explain and understanding tipping points and their many mysteries. And so I began again with a fresh sheet of paper. A revenge of The Tipping Point as a result, a new set of theories, stories, and arguments about the strange pathways that ideas and behavior follow through our world. The passive voice has also been associated. Chairwoman, I'd like to ask you one final question, and I'd like to begin with you, Doctor. Will you apologize to the American people? A group of politicians has called a hearing to discuss an epidemic. Three witnesses have been subpoenaed. It's the height of the pandemic. The meeting is virtual. Everyone is at home in front of bookcases and kitchen cabinets. We're an hour into the proceedings. I'm leaving out all the identifying details for the moment because I want to focus exclusively on what was said, the words that were used, and the intentions behind them. Witness one. I would be happy to apologize to the American people for all of the pain they have suffered and for the tragedies that they have experienced in their families. And I thought I did that earlier in my opening comments. That was my intention. When one is in her 70s, short white hair, dressed in black. At the beginning, she seemed to struggle with how to work the mute button. She still seems flustered. She isn't used to this. She comes from a world of privilege. Being confronted over her own behavior is clearly not something that has happened in her life with any frequency. Her fashionable glasses look like they might slide off when they end off her nose. What is one? I also am very angry. I'm angry that some people working at broke the law. I'm angry about it from 2007 and I'm angry about it now again in 2020. It is, I think that, chairwoman, I know you're angry, and I'm sorry, but that's not the apology we are looking for. You've apologized for the pain people have suffered, but you've never apologized for the role that you've played in the crisis. So I will ask you again, will you apologize for the role you've played in the crisis? Witness one, I've struggled with that question. I've asked myself over many years. I've tried to figure out is there anything that I could have done differently, knowing what I knew then, not what I know now? And I have to say, I can't. There's something that I can find that I would have done differently based on what I believed and understood then and what I learned from management and the reports from the board and what I learned from my colleagues on the board, and it's extremely distressing. And it's the chairwoman turns to witness too. He's the cousin of the woman in black, a young man, well manicured in a suit and tie. Mr., will you apologize for the role that you played? Well, that's two. I echo much of what my cousin said. Does anyone expect the witnesses to admit that they started an epidemic? Probably not. A squadron of lawyers has clearly coached them beforehand in the art of self-preservation. The rightness with which they deny responsibility, however, suggests another possibility, that they have not yet accepted their own culpability, or that they started something that spiraled out of control in a way they could not understand. An hour later comes a crucial moment. Another member of the investigating committee, let's call him the politician, turns to witness three. Doctor, has any execute in the company ever spent a day in jail for actions of corporations? I believe not. None of the witnesses hold themselves responsible, but apparently no one else does either. Madam Chair, it's easy to feel outrage about the misdeeds of this corporation, but what about our government that gives license to this kind of corporate irresponsibility and criminality and impunity? The politicians turned to witness to the young man. His family company has reached an agreement with the government to settle a series of criminal charges. He had once sat on the board of directors and is there apparent to the empire. Mr. As part of the DOJ settlements, didn't you have to admit any wrongdoing or liability on responsibility for causing a meritorious crisis? No, we did not. Were you interviewed by the Department of Justice as part of this investigation about your role in these events? No. Do you take any responsibilities for causing America's nightmarish experience with the crisis? Well, though I believe the full record, which has not been publicly released yet, will show that the family and the board acted legally and ethically. I take a deep moral responsibility for this because I believe our product, despite our best intention and best effort, has been associated with abuse and addiction, and he has been associated. You're using the passive voice where you say it's being associated with abuse, which implies somehow you and your family were not aware of exactly what was taking place. If you listen to all 3 hours and 39 minutes of the hearing, that single phrase stays in your head, the passive voice. 25 years ago, the tipping point, I was fascinated by the idea that in social epidemics, little things could make a big difference. I came up with the rules to describe the internal workings of social contagions, the law of the few, the power of context, the stickiness factor. Laws of epidemics, I argued, could be used to promote positive change, lower crime rates, teach kids how to read, curb cigarette smoking. Look at the world around you, I wrote. It may seem like an immovable, implacable place. It is not. With a slightest push in just the right place, it can be tipped. A revenge of the tipping point, I want to look at the underside of the possibilities I explored so long ago. If the world can be moved by just the lightest push, then the person who knows where and when to push has real power. So who are those people? And this is where we just have to end for today. And I hope that you took something with you and perhaps it piqued your curiosity and interest enough to want to read one of these books. If any of you have book recommendations beside you'd like to share here. And if you've written a book yourself that you'd like to see features, please reach out to me. To conclude, I would like to share a personal story with you where we say it is just in one sentence, because the story is that every unknown and every gap and every pause and every break can be your greatest time in your greatest moment. That wraps up our episode of We Empower, the weekly radio show dedicated to celebrating the strength, resilience, and limitless potential of women and men around the world. Don't hesitate to get involved. Your voice is valued. And together, we can make a difference. Thank you for being part of our community. Until next time, keep shining and empowering others. Together, we rise. Thank you for being here.